Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The U.S. Constitution was ratified 225 years ago. It was the subject of lively debate then and since. Throughout the decades of discourse, the debate has been fueled by what UMSL historian Dave Robertson calls intentional ambiguities. That has always given rise to individual and judicial interpretation. And polls tell us, however, that many, if not most, Americans don't really understand that document, what it says and does not say, and its relevance today. PBS is airing a four-part series on the Constitution and how the document is viewed by Americans of all political stripes. It's titled Constitution USA with Peter Sagal. That would be Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He traveled the country on a red, white, and blue Harley Davidson, taking the national pulse on today's meaning and relevance of the Constitution. He joins us by phone from Chicago. Peter, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. And with me in studio is Richard Beeman, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a renowned authority on the Revolutionary Era and the author of Plain Honest Men, The Making of the American Constitution. He also has a new book just out titled Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. Professor, nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Peter, I'd like to begin with you. I think some people might be surprised to find you in the middle of a discussion on the Constitution touring the country, especially on a red, white, and blue Harley Davidson.
That's, you know, I'm all about overcoming other people's low expectations of me.
Well, tell us about this project, how you got involved, and then we'll talk about some of the things you found out.
Sure. Well, I was approached a couple years ago now by Twin Cities Public TV and Insignia Productions, a documentary producer out of New York, and they had been asked to do a documentary about the Constitution, but they did not want to do, shall we say, a typical PBS documentary with an emphasis on history and experts sitting in front of bookcases. They wanted to sort of make it more relevant, make it more entertaining, make it more accessible, so they turned to me, famed for my career built on flatulence jokes and misbehaving politicians for public radio, to go out in the country to take a road trip and talk to people who were deeply involved in constitutional issues to see how the Constitution exists not as a historical document, but how it is lived today. And of course, if you're going to take a road trip across America to look for the spirit of the country, then you need to take a brightly painted Harley Davidson. I believe there's a federal law to that effect. And although while we do have experts, such as Professor Beeman right there with you, who is a central part of our documentary, instead of talking to him in his office with books in the background, we take him to a bar and give him a beer. That's why this is the new era of PBS documentaries.
No wonder he is so heavily involved in promoting this project.
It wasn't any old bar, though. It was City Tavern, where the founding fathers met after all of their sessions to get the real business done.
All right. Yeah. Well, historical context here. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, one of the great things about Rick is, you know, sadly the founders are dead, but Rick, I think, must have known them personally because he knows everything about them. And we would talk for a few hours over, we actually met in Constitution Hall. Rick managed to get us access to the chairs themselves. It was really quite something. And then he says, well, you know, they're only here for a few hours in the morning. And then everybody would go over to the City Tavern, have beers, and work out the real issues. And so we said, well, we must do that as well. So we did the same thing, which is why when you tune in, you'll see Rick and I sitting there with pewter mugs of ale talking about constitutional issues in the manner of our forefathers.
You know, things may not have changed all that much from what I read about some of our members of Congress. They pretty much react the same way on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, these guys, I mean, we think of these guys, and Rick here can speak to it, of course, far more authoritatively than I can, but we think of these guys as somewhat divine figures, you know, these enlightened, wise masters. And they were just, well, to use the ugly term, men. They did unpleasant things. They drank. Isn't it true, Rick, that Governor Morris, one of the founding fathers, lost his leg leaping out the window of his married mistress's bedroom?
Well, that's one of the great stories. It's never been proven, but it's a great story. He certainly had a very active extracurricular love life, Governor Morris.
Yeah,
did. Although, you know, I have to jump into the present. Indeed, the founding fathers spent a lot of time eating and drinking together, and that helped them overcome their differences. The real problem with our politicians today is that they don't do enough of it. they're getting out of Washington, going home, raising money for their next campaign, rather than developing that collegial sense.
That is cited again and again. They talk about the days not too long ago in which members of different parties would go out, their families would socialize. That's just not happening anymore. Peter, what are some of the things that jump out at you with regard to what you learned and may have surprised you during this cross-country jaunt?
Well, a lot of things surprised me. I met such a wide array of people, ranging from, a cannabis activist in Northern California who believes that the federal government shouldn't have any right to tell him what to do with medical marijuana if the people of California have decided otherwise, to Minnie Jean Brown Trickey, one of the Little Rock Nine, who we brought back to Little Rock Central High School, along with Marty Salmon, one of the 101st Airborne Troopers who escorted her to school back in 1957. But if there's one thing that I learned overall, it's that most people in America believe in the Constitution far more than they know about it. The analogy I can come up with is imagine a very religious Christian who's never read his or her Bible. They just sort of believe in it without knowing exactly what it says. And we're like that when it comes to the Constitution. And Rick, I know, has been going around the country and talking to people, and I think he's been finding this too. People have very strong feelings about it, but not a lot of specific knowledge.
It is remarkable. A recent survey of high school students reveals that fewer than half know what the three branches of the federal government are.
38%, I think, is the figure that I saw.
But there is this passion about the Constitution, and so that's both the opportunity and the challenge of this series. And Peter does such a wonderful job of it.
Peter and Professor, do you think part of that may be, I alluded to this in the introduction, that is that there were intentional ambiguities because these guys, in putting this together, knew they had to have it ratified and voted upon and therefore tended to be less specific on occasion. What do you think, Peter?
Well, one of my favorite moments in the whole documentary is when we're sitting in Constitution Hall with Rick and I say, so I don't understand. Did the founders want a powerful central government that could do all these things, or did they want a limited central government that could only do these certain things? And Rick looks me in the eye and the camera and says, "I don't know." And the fact that the greatest living expert on the Constitutional Convention sitting there with you can't answer that authoritatively, I think speaks to the ambiguities that they built into this thing.
I think. Some of it may have been intentional because they were creating a framework, not a specific guide. But a lot of it, I think, was unintentional. This was a fragile experiment on which they were embarked. So to some extent, they were making it up as they went along.
And today we live with the consequences of that because obviously there's a lot of it subject to interpretation. Peter, during your trek, did you find that people wanted to talk most about the so-called hot-button issues that we're all talking about today, gun control and gay marriage and things of that sort?
I do like the idea of taking a trek. I'm a big Trek fan. the most people believe that the Constitution exists to protect their right to do whatever it is that they individually want to do. So Second Amendment fans, gun people, were very interested in the Second Amendment. Other people were very interested in the First Amendment. Religious people very interested in the First Amendment as well. The Constitution, generally speaking, is believed to be what the people need it to be, that they can live how they want, and they see any encroachment on that self-perceived right to be a violation of the Constitution. And sometimes it is. But a lot of times it's not. And one of the things that was really fascinating to me was the learning about the incredibly complicated mechanism by which the letters, the words in the Constitution have become law, have become the way of life, the compromises we've made, the changes we've made. No right is absolute. No principle can't be changed. No language can't be reinterpreted. That it isn't this unchanging shield bestowed upon us, like, the shield of Iron Man given to him by, the shield of Captain America given to him by Tony Stark's father. It is this thing that we recreate for ourselves with every generation and every day.
And each generation looks to what we call original intent, what these founder fathers and the drafters of the Constitution really had in mind. Is it possible, Professor, to get any real sense of original intent?
Well, I'm going to give you the same answer that I gave Peter when he asked me the question about the balance of government power versus individual liberty. There were 55 delegates to the Constitutional Convention, and there were often 55 different views on so many of those issues, particularly on that big issue of the balance between governmental power and individual liberty. Just to follow up on Peter, who is 100% correct in his discussion of the way Americans view the Constitution. Overwhelmingly, Americans do believe that the Constitution is there to protect their individual liberties, and that that's what the original intent of the framers was. But those framers gathered in Philadelphia in the midst of a national crisis. The country was in debt. It was divided. And they wrote a preamble which charged government with the responsibility of establishing justice, ensuring domestic tranquility, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare, and so on. That required a government with energy. Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple of things pop into my mind with regard to the way people look at it. And Peter and Professor, get your response to this. There are those who will insist, for instance, that the separation of church and state is something that is put in the Constitution for all of us to pay some attention to. There are other things as well. But the fact of the matter is that that appears nowhere in the Constitution, nor does the word slavery.
No, it doesn't. And yet we had slavery. There are two different issues, and again, I think Rick is really your guy to talk to you about their original intent. I'll say that although the phrase separation of church and state, a wall between church and state, doesn't appear in the Constitution, it's a principle that we've applied over the last 60 years, since the 1950s on, that there shouldn't be any government sponsorship of religion in sometimes almost trivial ways. I think whether or not that's what the founders intended, it's what we, the modern Americans, have decided is right. And I think we've done that for very good reasons, not only to protect the government from being aligned with any particular religion, but allow religion to be free from government interference. It's the best thing that's ever happened for religion, is to get the government out of it. If you don't believe me, go over to England and attend a Church of England service and see how enthusiastic they are about their state church. Here in America, religion thrives because it is totally separated from the government. Is that what the founders wanted? I don't know. Maybe Rick does. Has that been our decision as modern Americans that that's what's best for the government and for religion? Yes. And I think evidence shows that we were correct.
One of the reasons it was so great to work with Peter is that I agree with him virtually all the time. And he summarized precisely what's happened to that wall of separation over the course of the last 60 years. I think it really is important to note, though, that nowhere, at no time during that summer in 1787, did the framers talk about installing religion in their Constitution. The only time in which religion is mentioned in the Constitution is in the clause that says there shall be no religious test for public office. They really did understand that they were creating a secular document. Now, how high that wall of separation should be, you would have had 55 different opinions.
Well, this is often referred to as a living document, and I guess that relates to exactly what Peter was just saying with regard to the way people have accepted and interpreted and implemented this particular part of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's an argument about the living Constitution versus the originalist version.
Right.
And that often is just a euphemism for conservative versus liberal. And I don't think that's right. This is what I think. Again, after talking to experts like Rick and traveling the country, I think that you can argue, if you want to, that we should try to decipher, as the scholars like Rick and Ouija boards or whatever else you need, what the founders intended, and then try to follow those dictates in terms of interpreting the Constitution. You can say we should do that. What you can argue is that we have done that, because we haven't. That the entire history of the American experiment is one of each generation looking at the Constitution, deciding what it means and what it needs to mean for them. We've changed our minds a lot. We used to think that the Constitution completely allowed segregation. We decided that after the case of Plessy v. Ferguson. And then in 1956, or we decided something different after a different court case. And like I said, The Constitution is a piece of paper. It's four pieces of parchment. You can go see them in the National Archives. By itself, it doesn't do anything. And it is only active in our country to the extent that we understand it, we put it into action, we follow its dictates as we understand them. So like I said, whether or not you think that's a good idea that we've interpreted the Constitution to suit ourselves, it's indisputable that that's what we've done.
So we are the final determinators, if you will, of what the Constitution says and doesn't say, as opposed to, Professor, the courts?
Well, what I'm about to say, if Justice Antonin Scalia were in the room here with me, he might want to try to rebut what I'm about to say. But I truly do believe that over the course of our history, it has been we the people, not we the people in the latest CNN or Fox News poll, but in the settled opinion of we the people who have shaped what our Constitution says and means. I've always said, by the way, that the Constitution, if you read it, you know, if you read the preamble of the Declaration of Independence, it's pretty inspiring. It's poetic. You read the Constitution, it reads kind of like a prenuptial agreement. It's not all that interesting. It is the living Constitution. And if I may put in a plug for Constitution USA, the great thing about this series is that it tells the story of the Constitution in important stories involving real people. It's not like a prenuptial agreement.
Yeah. Peter only has a few more minutes with us, and there is a caller on the line already whose comment I believe will be relevant to this part of our discussion. So let's bring in Jerry from O'Fallon. Jerry, it'll have to be quick, though.
Okay, yes, it is. It's like the Bible. People choose the parts they agree with. But in my estimation, we should have followed Thomas Jefferson's advice and changed it every 19 years. And let me just give you one example of, I think, interpretation being essentially looking for loopholes. According to the Constitution, war can only be declared by Congress. And the last time we did that was just about 72 years ago. And we've been involved in several, whatever you want to call them, wars since. And I think that that is an absolute perversion of the intent, if not the letter of the law. But since it's so broadly written, we're stuck with it.
That's a good point. And you raise actually an interesting point, a couple of points that I'll try to respond to before I got to go. The first is about changing the Constitution. It's really hard to do. It was designed to be hard to do. And I think that's a good thing. The one time we tried to use the Constitution to basically legislate to ban alcohol, it was a disaster, and we had to take it back a few years later. The Constitution isn't supposed to control how we live so much, in my view. It's supposed to control how we govern ourselves. And questions like alcohol and all those other things really, and to a great extent, with very few exceptions, belong in the legislative process. That's what the Constitution gives us. It doesn't solve arguments. It gives us a opportunity and a mechanism to have them in a relatively peaceful way. In regard to the war powers, that's a really interesting example that I've been saying all along, and I've gotten into trouble for this from some people in the far right wing, that the Constitution is like Tinkerbell in that it only exists if we all agree to believe in it, if we all agree to carry out its dictates. If we all stop, it goes away. The War Powers Act, or the war power in the Constitution, is a great example. The Constitution says that only Congress can declare war. And that hasn't happened, as far as I know, since World War II. And yet we've had all these wars. Well, what happened? Well, what happened is we all sort of collectively decided to let that one slide. And it's the only example I can think of is in the movie, this is also for my dork friends out there who I know are listening, in the movie Back to the Future, when Marty McFly is looking at his picture and his parents start to fade. It's we have let that particular thing fade. There wasn't any court decision. There wasn't any, you know, we didn't all get together and vote on it, but we've just stopped paying attention to that. So that part of the Constitution is fading away. And that could happen to all of it if we do not pay attention and insist that it still applies.
And, Professor, I'll just ask you for a quick take on a new Constitution every 19 years. or so.
It's hard for a professor to have a quick take. But Jefferson, writing to James Madison, really did argue that every generation that we should write a new Constitution and that one generation should not bind the other. Madison had a very thoughtful response, a rebuttal to that, and Jefferson didn't win the day on that one.
Obviously. Peter Hegel, we want to thank you so much for being with us. I know you've got a scoot, and we appreciate your taking some time to spend it with us here in St. Louis. Thank
you
so much.
It's my pleasure. I love St. Louis, and hope to be back soon.
And we'll all look forward to the continuing episodes of Constitution USA with Peter Hegel. Airs on 9 PBS Tuesdays at 8 o'clock, which means it started last night. It's repeated, though, on Thursdays at 2 a.m., beginning May 9th on 9 PBS.
Let me also just say before I go that those who couldn't see it on TV or can't for whatever reason can stream each episode online at the PBS.org website. Just find our show there, and you'll be able to stream each episode online the day after it's broadcast, meaning episode one is available today.
Oh, excellent. I'm glad you brought that up. And if folks don't do that, they can set the recorder for 2 o'clock tomorrow morning.
And for no other reason, you have got to see how Rick Beeman rocks a bow tie.
Well, I can see it, but okay, I'm with you on that. I'm sure people will enjoy it. Peter Hegel, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you soon.
We'll be back with Professor Richard Beeman in just a moment to continue our discussion. We'll take your calls as well. If you have questions pertaining to the Constitution and what you understand and perhaps don't understand about it, we've got the guy here to answer those questions, Professor Richard Beeman, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, tweet us at STL on air, or reach us through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air, St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on the Constitution. This conversation is pegged on the fact that 9 PBS is airing a four-part series, Constitution USA, with Peter Hegel, which began last night. And by the way, the first episode will be repeated overnight at 2 o'clock on Channel 9. And as Peter Hegel told us just a moment ago before he left, you can go to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me website, and you can stream it that way as well. With me in studio is Professor Richard Beeman, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Plain Honest Men, The Making of the American Constitution. He's involved very heavily in the production of Constitution USA with Peter Hegel. He's also the author of a brand new book, Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. You know, we talked a moment ago, Professor, about people who have suggested going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson that we revise the Constitution periodically. I've been reading recently that our Constitution, which had been a model for many other constitutions around the world, is no longer the preferred document. They're going to Canada, for instance, for its document.
You know, you have a very distinguished professor at Washington University at St. Louis who's written a very important article on this subject. Looking at the way in which constitutions all around the world have been framed and then comparing them with ours. And ours is now an outlier on many, many fronts. First of all, and I personally believe this is a good thing, not a bad thing, it's very short. The typical constitutions are hundreds of pages long. Our Bill of Rights is only 10 articles. The declarations of human rights in most constitutions are 40, 50, 60. And ours is still one of the few presidential systems in the world. Most are parliamentary democracies. So does this mean that we're kind of falling behind? I don't think so. I think it means that we managed to do for us what was best for us.
Do we really want the rest of the world to go to the Electoral College system?
No, I hope not. And I don't think the rest of the world is anxious to do that either.
I would think not. I have a quick email here from Melanie before I go to the phones, who writes, "This conversation reminds me of the episode of The West Wing when the White House staff directed to find a copy of the Constitution and ask, is it still in print? People lose their knowledge of the Constitution after passing their eighth grade or high school required course. I keep a copy of it and the Declaration of Independence at my desk, on my Kindle, and in my purse at all times. I don't have the occasion to use it regularly, but I like to have it on hand if I happen to get a question." Do you carry a copy, Professor?
Well, your listeners couldn't see me reach into my coat pocket to bring out my copy of the pocket Constitution. I literally carry it with me at all times, not only because I revere it, but because you've already said that I've been a professor at Penn for 45 years. So I'm not a spring chicken. So my memory is not what it used to be. I really need to refer to it.
Well, I like people who are not spring chickens, not being one myself. Let's bring Marion into the conversation. She will address, I think, this part of what we're talking about. Marion, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to agree with the previous person who sent in the email and pretty much everything that's been said. I want to tell you I've been an educator. I taught in St. Louis Public High Schools and other places, and I've also been a lawyer since 1975. So I want to know if your distinguished guest or anybody out in radio land can explain if our Constitution is so important, and that's the premise and our belief, why isn't the teaching of the Constitution introduced in all public education from K through 12? Sesame Street has proven that you can teach little children complicated concepts, and much of the Constitution is quite simple. It's the interpretation and discussion of it. And I'll just say one other thing. It's important for governance, to understand governance. It's important for assimilation of our immigrants. And it reinforces the sharing of values. And if kids can learn NFL rules and NBA rules and both the minor and major league rules of any other sports, they can learn the rules of our governance. And I'd like to know why it's not taught.
You know, I just must say amen to that. It is one of the great paradoxes that, on the one hand, we are a nation whose adults, anyway, seem quite passionate in their views about how our Constitution should be interpreted. But the teaching of, quote, civics has just fallen by the wayside. Maybe we shouldn't call it civics anymore. I mean, I think one of the, again, the great things about Constitution USA, it takes real-life people with some very important contemporary events and makes the Constitution come alive. But I have great sympathy for teachers of American history and civics around the country, particularly K through 8, who have not had the resources to make this thing come alive.
You know, it sounds like this program is fun. I mean, with Peter Sagal being a part of it, it certainly has to have that element. And perhaps he was right at the very beginning. You may take exception to this when he talked about the professors and ivy-colored halls, you know, or boring people to death with this talk.
I did notice that comment by Peter. I was about to leap in. The best teachers at any level are teachers who make their subject come alive and seem relevant to the lives of the students, whatever their age, whom they are teaching. But I don't think we're giving teachers enough support in doing that.
What do you think today are the most relevant parts of our Constitution for today's society?
Wow, there are just so many.
I
mean, we do continue to have this big debate about the role of government in people's lives, with some people feeling passionately that the government has destroyed the Constitution by its excessive exercise of power. The debate over Obamacare was only the most recent of those sorts of debates. And those are debates where we can go back in history and sort of trace the evolution of government and its relationship to the people. That was a debate that had some interesting history. The debate over gay marriage, that's a tougher one. I'm pretty sure that the Founding Fathers didn't spend a millisecond in 1787 thinking about gay marriage.
Let's return to the phones, and we'll bring John to the conversation. John, come on in. But before you do, I misspoke a moment ago when we talked about where you can watch the streaming version of this program, The Constitution USA with Peter Sagal. It's not on the Wait, Don't Tell Me website. It's on the PBS website. So if you want to watch last night's opening episode, you can find it there and stream it, or you can record it tomorrow morning at 2 o'clock on Channel 9. Okay, John, sorry to hold you up. Come on in.
Thank you very much. Professor Beeman, I'm looking at your book as we speak. I've been a member of the History Book Club. That's where I got it from for years and years. I thoroughly enjoyed your book. It was even better than Miracle at Philadelphia.
Well, that's a great compliment. Thank you.
I was going to say, I hope you consider that a compliment.
It is indeed.
And let me just say, anybody who's interested in the Constitution needs to pick up this book. It is just excellent. A couple of things. Number one, I wish you would comment a little bit on how some people opposed the Constitution because they said that the convention overstepped its mandate by forming the Constitution rather than just revising the Articles of Confederation, which it's my understanding was their original mandate. And in talking about the abuse of power of government, talk a little bit about the Articles of Confederation and what a disaster that was and why it pointed to the need for a stronger central government. And finally, I have to say I have no patience with people who say that the Constitution is a Christian document. There is a person by the name of David Barton who writes on this. Fortunately, I believe he has been exposed as the charlatan that he is. But if you would comment on the secular nature, which I know you touched on earlier, but if you would comment on the secular nature of the Constitution, I would be glad to hear those thoughts. And again, sir, thank you very much for this book, and I'm going to buy your next one.
Thank you. I'll try to answer some big questions as briefly as I can. In fact, the framers of the Constitution in Philadelphia did exceed their mandate from the Continental Congress. They were there to consider amendments to the Articles of Confederation, and pretty much from day one, they decided to scrap the Articles of Confederation and create an entirely new document. Some scholars have actually argued that this was a sort of illegal, unconstitutional act. But one of their final actions was, of course, to decide how this Constitution would become legitimate. And it would become legitimate by being submitted to we the people of the United States in a ratification debate in every one of the 13 states. One of the remarkable things about that debate, it is a very, very vociferous debate. And many, many Americans voted against the Constitution, believing that it did represent a threat to their individual liberties. They were fearful of big government. They'd fought a revolution against big government. But again, one of the other remarkable facts is that almost as soon as it's narrowly ratified, it becomes the Holy Grail.
Well, interestingly, I mentioned, alluded to this before, and the fact is that these gentlemen in Philadelphia knew that it had to go to a vote, and they had to act accordingly. I mean, they were savvy enough politically to know that they had to have a document that would be accepted.
That's right. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
I have to take another break. You've been listening to Richard Beeman, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. He is one of the key ingredients in the four-part PBS series airing on Channel 9 here, Constitution USA with Peter Sagal. Peter Sagal joined us a little bit earlier. The series is airing at 8 o'clock on Tuesday evenings. It started last night. You can record it tonight at 2 o'clock when it's repeated, or you can stream it on the PBS website. Richard Beeman, our guest, will come back and take more of your calls in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Professor Richard Beeman of the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the Constitution. Let's go back to the phone. Our friend Chris in St. Louis has been waiting for quite a while. Chris, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me okay, sir?
Sure.
Okay, at first I want to give a shout-out to one of my old high school history teachers who sparked a fire, a lifelong fire, and an appreciation for history. So kudos to the professor for that. And also, the gentleman before me kind of previewed a little bit. I agree that I think our forefathers came here for freedom from religion. I think they were actually fleeing from, you know, having to choose one religion and one only. And my question is, I'm of the mindset, I think it's great that we have freedom of religion for all the peoples that come here and practice their religion and, you know, in safety and freely. But my mindset is that this country is freedom from religion. You're welcome to choose whichever and practice it freely. But as the gentleman said before, I don't think that religion should be part of the Constitution. And every presidential election, that's the foremost topic is religion, when there's so many other things that are more important you know, that are in the reality of living in America. So I just like the professor's opinion on it. Does he believe it's freedom from religion or freedom of religion? And I'll just listen. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure I'd want to make the distinction. I think it is both. But Peter Sagal earlier really, I think, summarized this very well. We are an incredibly religious country. If you compare the percentage of people who attend church in America with the people who attend church in most countries in Europe, we're way above them. And the Thomas Jefferson in particular understood two things. First of all, he really was a child or citizen of the Enlightenment, and really did believe that freedom of and freedom from religion was one of the fundamental inherent natural rights. But he also was a practical man. And what are the two most contentious things in all of life? Politics and religion. It's just a bad idea to mix those things together. And although America was overwhelmingly a, quote, Christian nation in the 18th century, it was a highly diverse Christian nation with Anglicans and Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians, some Catholics, a few Jews. This was a dangerous combination. So I think they had the common sense, the practicality to keep these things separate. And it's worked very well for us.
I wonder how their church-going practices might compare to today's. Do you have any sense of that at all?
Well, it
probably a little more difficult.
It depends on who you're looking at. Mm-hmm. You know, George Washington, who was a nominal Anglican or Episcopalian after independence, attended church three times during the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, all on largely ceremonial occasions. On the other hand, Samuel Johnson, a Puritan from Connecticut, attended every day. So, you know, the range of religious belief and intensity was as great then as it is today.
It's probably pretty much the same. It sounds like it. I have an email here from Aaron. In response to why kids can learn rules to sports but not governing, is that kids use the rules to sports by playing them and watching them. In other words, the rules are relevant to them as kids. As proponents of learning, we first need to make kids curious about the rules of governing.
What a great insight. I have nothing to add to that. It's a brilliant insight. But there are perhaps some lessons there in terms of how we teach.
Right. And that could apply to a great many subjects, not just civics, right. Needless to say. Why is it, Professor Beeman, that the framers did not include the Bill of Rights in the eventual document? They talked about all of these things, but it took 2 years before we got the Bill of Rights.
Right, and I hope your listeners will watch the second episode of Constitution USA, because Peter Sagal and I are sitting in City Tavern drinking ale while I answer that question to him. They had some formal defenses after the fact when people said, why didn't you include a Bill of Rights? And they said things like, well, it would be redundant to the state constitutions, so we didn't need to. Some of them said, well, there was always a fear that we might leave a couple out, so we thought it was best to leave it out and leave it to the states. But honestly, on September 12th, 5 days before the convention adjourned, George Mason of Virginia stood up and said, I think we should add a Bill of Rights. He was a drafter of the Virginia Bill of Rights, so he had a kind of pride in it. And he said, so I think we can do it in a couple of hours. And the framers, now I'm making this up, but I'm making it up with an informed sense of what they must have been thinking at that time. They said, good luck. There's no way we're going to do this in 2 hours. It's going to take us another 2 months. We want to go home. So I think they were tired and they wanted to get the heck out of Philadelphia.
It was a lousy hot summer in Philadelphia.
That's
Who
right.
can blame her for that? Another thought that I'd like to get from your response to you is all the discussion we're hearing these days with regard to legislating from the bench. What is your feeling about what's going on with this current Supreme Court and some of the issues that it's tackled?
Well, you know, it's interesting that in the debate between left and right, it's usually thought of as liberal judges who are the activists legislating from the bench. Justice Scalia does often accuse people on the left from doing that. But now the originalists on the right are also very active in imposing their view of our Constitution. So, for example, in the case of McDonald v. Illinois, the gun control case, which ruled the Chicago gun control unconstitutional, that was overturning legislation from the city of Chicago from the bench.
Right. And what about the court ruling on the presidential election in 2000? Should the court have taken that issue?
Boy. you've got me stumped, literally. Had they let it play out in Florida, there would have been serious consequences there. Was it wise to do what they did? I don't think so either. It is quite interesting that the judges in the majority in that case are very quick to say, well, this doesn't set any precedents. So it was a bad solution to a really bad situation.
We had talked earlier on about the intentional ambiguity the framers utilized during their whole process, and yet they made the document very, very difficult to amend. That would make me think that perhaps they were quite happy with what they had done and weren't concerned about that ambiguity and how it might play out over the generations.
It's a good question. I wish you were able to put it to them, because they might be able to give you a more self-confident answer than I. They did think they were creating a broad framework. They weren't creating pieces of legislation. So the difficulty in amending the Constitution, the high bar that they set, was that I think they probably did not want the kind of fundamental framework that they were creating to be changed easily.
We have limited time because I know you have to scoot in just a bit, but I want to bring in Dennis calling from Overland for a final thought. Dennis, go ahead, but time's a-wasting.
Yes, I just was telling your screener, E.B. White had a story many years ago called Bedfellows. And he talks about reading, you know, Adlai Stevenson and all these different people. But in the course of the story, his wife comes in and makes a comment about the fact that they are going to have a prayer vigil at the White House. And she was very, very upset. And it's, I think it should be required reading for everybody, because it gives some perspective, and it hasn't lost its power, you know, so. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you. E.B. White's required reading on so many wonderful topics.
We have another email here I'll read. This is from Brian. It says, on the religion issue, the First Amendment only limited Congress's involvement in establishing religion. The states were still able and often willing to establish churches. That's important to remember, even if one accepts that the 14th Amendment extended the ban to the states.
That is technically correct. At the time the First Amendment was drafted, and by the way, the First Amendment has two provisions. It guarantees the free exercise of religion and also says that Congress shall not provide for an establishment of religion. At the time that amendment was drafted and then adopted 2 years later, there were three states, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, which still had established religions. So the First Amendment, before the passage of the 14th Amendment, did apply only to Congress, not to the states. But it is an important fact that by the early 1830s, every state in America had passed laws disestablishing religion. So all of our state governments have ultimately embraced this idea of no religious establishment.
In the areas of vision and farsightedness, if you will, as one who reveres the Constitution, what kind of marks do you give the framers for that vision?
With one notable exception, I give them very, very, very high marks. Again, you know, when I'm sorry, but when I compare the 55 men who gathered in Philadelphia in 1787 with the 535 who are gathered in Washington, D.C. today, I would take a random selection of those 55 over any selection of the 535. But they failed to have foresight on one issue, and that was the issue of slavery. Mm-hmm. To me, a dramatic moment in that is in the debate over the continuation of the African slave trade, which overwhelmingly the delegates were repulsed by. And the only reason that the slave trade was continued for another 20 years, which, by the way, allowed for the importation of 200,000 additional African slaves into the country, was that the delegates gave in. They compromised, if you will, to the South Carolinians and the Georgians. But in the midst of that debate, Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut stands up and said, why are we spending so much time on this issue? In 30 years' time, slavery will not be a speck in our country. He was quite wrong.
He was quite wrong. Richard Beaman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been a delight talking to you. And we'll remind folks that you're heavily involved when the Channel 9 PBS series Constitution USA with Peter Sagal. A pleasure seeing you. The book that folks ought to read if they want to get more of your insight into the Constitution is Plain Honest Men, The Making of the American Constitution. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. It's a real –
thanks so much.
Real pleasure to be here.
We're going to take a couple of moments now to talk to our own Chris McDaniel of St. Louis Public Radio News. He's the curator of a new feature on our website called By the Numbers, Lobbying in Missouri. Chris, good to see you again.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Update us. The last time we talked, this had just gotten started. Where are we now in terms of what you've learned?
Well, the last time I was on, I believe we were at about $336,000, and that was for January and February, so in 2 months. Now we have the March numbers. They just came out last week, and we've now crossed $450,000. One of the interesting things about this is, you know, $450,000 is a lot of money, so I wanted to see if this was, you know, somewhat anomalous, if this was much more than it had been in previous years. So I went back through about 8 years' worth of lobbying reports, and at the moment we're slightly above average. Normally we would be at about $425,000 for 3 months, and we're at $452,000. But it's not very anomalous. This is about par for the course.
So it doesn't really tell us anything is very much different now than has been the case.
Exactly.
But you found a couple of very interesting what's the word I should use for this? I want to say donations. I guess that would apply.
Yes. Well, you know, for this feature, we're trying to illustrate the systematic complications of the way it's done. So we're trying not to single out too many individual gifts, but there were a few that we couldn't resist because they were just so silly. One of them is apparently in March, the Senate had a bowling tournament that was sponsored by various lobbyists, and they foot the bill for lanes, food, drinks, and even T-shirts. And another noteworthy gift was that so far this year, one senator has received about $450 worth of jelly beans, M&Ms, and soda for his office, bought by James R. Moody and Associates and, somewhat ironically, Consumer Healthcare Products Association.
Well, didn't I read somewhere that $450 would buy a couple of tons of M&Ms or whatever?
Yeah, it's about 50 pounds worth of jelly beans if you're just buying jelly beans.
And just we have just about a minute left. Who's topping the list this time? We have a new number one receiver.
Senator Ryan Silvey is the legislator who's received the most. He overtook Senator Jamila Nasheed. As far as who the biggest lobbyist is, it remains Ameren. And I believe they are at around 20,000, 28,000, in fact.
Are you hearing in 40 seconds, are you hearing anything? I know you're soliciting comment from people who visit the website, stlpublicradio.org. What are you hearing from folks who are visiting?
Well, the response from people who visit our site has been very good. I'm working on a story, a radio feature about this. And as far as individual legislators getting back, that's a bit more difficult.
Well, we'll listen to what you have to report with regard to what folks are saying about it. It's a most interesting project, and this will continue. What happens when the legislative session ends this month?
Well, after the legislative session ends, we still have data to come back because we're about 2 months behind in terms of getting this public data. So there will be plenty to do over the summer for sure.
Chris McDaniel, keep up the good work. We'll look forward to talking to you again about this. It's fascinating stuff.
Thanks for having me,
Don. Especially the M&Ms and jelly beans. So, of course, Ronald Reagan was a big jelly bean guy, so I guess it's something politicians do. Thanks, Chris. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the proposed residential program for women, Magdalen St. Louis, which is scheduled to open here in 2014. We'll talk about its services for women who are coming out of prostitution, violence, and drug abuse. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.